Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time for our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Good morning.
And Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Thanks. Good morning.
And Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome, Jim.
Good to be here.
But not back. Jim Siegel, ECOT. The Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow begins its appeal of a state audit that seriously questions the number of students who participate minimally in the online charter schools curriculum as required by the state. What's at stake here? What's going on?
Well, the appeal starts this morning. It's in front of a hearing officer that's working for the Department of Education. What will happen is they'll present their case. The state will defend it. Present their case why whether these are legitimate attendance audits that were done, and the state will defend it. The hearing officer will then make a recommendation to the full board, State Board of Education. The state board will then decide if the attendance audit is valid, and if so, to what extent it's valid. And then unless there is an agreement reached ahead of time between ECOT and the Department of Ed on some kind of a settlement, and a settlement would be because right now, the state basically says that ECOT has been inflating its attendance by about 60%, and that's roughly they stand to lose about $60 million if this attendance audit is upheld, and that's because the data that ECOT turned over in terms of login durations and offline tracking of work showed that the vast majority of students were well below the 920 hours of required learning opportunities that the state wants each year.
So what kind of arguments does ECOT have in its favor? This is data that they gave to the state. The state just analyzed it.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how they're – I watched them argue this in court, and it's one thing to make the legal arguments to a judge about whether or not, the state had the legal authority to to break or not, to potentially violate a funding agreement that was signed by the state and ECOT back in 2003, whether they had the authority to under state law to do what they were doing, whether they were making an unlawful rule change. I don't know how much of the nitty-gritty legal arguments they'll get into. I'm just not sure, because I don't know that's what the hearing officer is necessarily going to care about.
Yeah.
But they may focus on things like, look, they changed the Department of Education changed the process on us in the middle of the year. They didn't really announce until halfway through the school year that they were going to require us to do these login durations and make us turn this data over, and therefore we were not prepared to do so. The state will no doubt argue, look, under House Bill 2, under our prior attendance audit manuals, we were clearly given the authority to do this. And look, this is 2016. You should have the technology available to track whether your students are logged in or not. And if you're not, if you're not tracking whether they're logging in and actually doing the assignments, then what are you doing? What is going on there that you can't at least tell whether these students are logged in or not, and whether they're participating in a 30 hours a week, 20 hours a week, or whether they're participating, 2 hours a week or 2 hours a month.
Mm-hmm. There's seven charter schools, electronic e-schools that are appealing this. Laura
right. Bischoff? And I think ECOT is just the first of the seven.
And of the seven.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it brings up the overall policy questions of, like, how do we know that tax money is not being wasted? And how do we know that kids are learning? And I think it's interesting that ECOT has been relying on this agreement that was signed back in 2003. I mean, that was 13 years ago. So for the last 13 years, the state really hasn't had a good handle on how these online learners, how much are they logging in, how are they learning, what kind of accountability there is, that's pretty astonishing to me that it's gone on for more than a dozen years.
Yeah, in some ways it's more a reflection of the state than even the schools.
Well, and I think there were some folks who were thinking that maybe some of this would be addressed in the lame duck session of the legislature, but it doesn't look like. I mean, we're running out of time here. They're supposed to be done later this week, and I haven't heard anything about any movement of any bills with regard to charter school transparency or accountability for where students are, when, and that sort of thing. So I think, as this trial, as this hearing is going on, there's also the question of what's the legislature doing about this.
Right. I mean, nothing to address these concerns. On the contrary, I think Jim Siegel, you wrote about how some Republican lawmakers are at work to protect the online charter schools from these kinds of audits. How so?
Well, the ECOT and some of these other e-schools that are currently facing significant funding losses because of these audits and because they cannot prove how much time their students are spending on classwork, they have gone to the legislature and they have, you know, really hard pitched their case that they should somehow get shielded from these financial penalties, at least for this year. They're not – I don't think they're bold enough to try to ask for it for, you know, extended beyond that. But at least for this year, they're saying, look, this – like as I said before, their key argument is they changed the rules on us, and so you should protect us from these penalties this year so that next year we'll be okay and they'll come back, and that's when the consequences will kick in if we don't do it right next year. However, I talked last week to both the Speaker of the House, Cliff Rosenberger, and the House Finance Chairman, or I'm sorry, House Education Chairman, Andy Brenner. Both of them said it does not appear they're going to do that, at least not this year, not this week. You know, when I say this year, this week is the last week of the General Assembly. So if it doesn't get done this week, everything resets and goes back to square one. They doubt it's going to get done this week. However, doesn't mean it won't get done next year in some fashion. And, you know, ECOT right now, and I don't know if I've seen it on television anywhere, but they have an ad running, at least online, that is a pretty significant ad in terms of call your politicians.
I have seen it on television. They're going
directly after Speaker Cliff Rosenberger's district, saying that, you know, if you shut down ECOT, you're going to shut down 1,000 jobs, and that would be like closing all these schools in Clinton and Highland counties, which is Rosenberger's district. And so they are targeting him specifically, and they really are putting the pressure on trying to get folks to, and I'm sure lawmakers' phones have been lighting up with ECOT supporters, because ECOT is good at rallying people to their cause.
And not without its clout, right?
Right.
I mean, Bill Lager, the owner of ECOT, has donated a lot of money to Republicans who control the Ohio General Assembly.
And he's got there's a blog that's now really going after some of these ECOT issues that's thought to be connected to Bill Lager. But I think, you know,
you would expect
an online school to be able to bring people in online and get, you know, social media engaged, I guess. And so, Jim's right. They've been very good at mobilizing forces to try to stop things or change things, at least so far.
I think using the blog, this Third Rail Politics blog, is an interesting tactic because it employs kind of like a news site that is financially backed. Apparently, I mean, it looks like there's ties definitely between Third Rail Politics and Bill Lager. So it's almost like, you know, putting up your own journalism front to then push your issue, which is another.
But anybody who reads it would say that it's not journalism like what
it's
we
more
practice.
Like columnists or people telling their stories.
It's definitely got a bent to it, an agenda, especially when you come down to stories about ECOT, for instance.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Karen Kessler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us on our weekly reporters roundtable, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Okay, so turning to Republican state politics, always an interesting topic since Republicans pretty much control the entire state. Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges has found himself, not surprisingly, in the crosshairs of President-elect Donald Trump himself. Laura Bischoff, Borges backed John Kasich for president. Where's the foul here? I mean, there wasn't nothing wrong with that, right?
No, nothing wrong with that. However, there was some indications that maybe Borges and the Ohio Republican Party weren't 1,000% behind Trump once Trump got the nomination. When that hot mic video came out where Trump was heard on Access Hollywood making crude comments, Matt Borges actually said to the media, to multiple outlets, that really he wasn't sure who he was going to vote for. And Team Trump did not take that well. And now it looks like Jane Murphy Timken, who's the vice chair of the Stark County GOP, is going to challenge him when he's up for re-election by the Central Committee in January. And Timken sent a letter to the Central Committee saying that President-elect Trump supports a leadership change within the Ohio Republican Party. Now, this is interesting because, you know, Borges is John Kasich's pick to run the Republican Party. I think it was in 2011, maybe just before that, Kevin DeWine from Fairborn over by Dayton, he was the chairman of the party, and he had just won, like, everything. And when I think John Kasich went to Kevin DeWine and said, hey, I want to appoint my own chairman, and Kevin DeWine said, go pound salt. Like, I just won everything, and I was just reelected. And so Kasich took the his allies took the unprecedented tactic of basically replacing a lot of members of the Central Committee through a lot of, you know, grassroots stocking the committee. And then next thing you know, DeWine no longer had the support to maintain his chairmanship, and Matt Borges was installed. So, you know, it seems like now Borges may be on the outs with somebody at an even higher power.
And Borges was challenged at one point by Tom Zalistowski, big Tea Party guy up in Northeast Ohio. And he was saying yesterday that he supports this challenge now, too, from Jane Murphy Timken. So this is not the first time that the Tea Party wing, so to speak, has challenged Matt Borges.
Well, and John Kasich ruffled a lot of feathers along the way when he replaced Kevin DeWine. And so there's probably lots of people out there that aren't too sad to see this happen.
No, I mean, obviously, the Borges, I'm sure, has friends and enemies, just like any party chairman is going to have. But the difference there is that takeover was coming from inside the state. I mean, that was Governor Kasich wanting to basically make the party his own. And this is Donald Trump trying to kick out somebody who he didn't feel was, you know, sufficiently loyal to him. And, you know, that I think might have a different – get some different reaction, particularly, again, coming off the year that Matt Borges just had in Ohio, where he was obviously the Republicans were very successful.
Right. 2 weeks ago, I had the former Ohio Republican Party chair, Kevin DeWine, who Laura just mentioned, and former Democratic Party chair, David Leland, on our show, The State of Ohio, which airs on WOSU-TV, as a matter of fact. And Kevin DeWine was saying it was his impression that the most powerful Republican in Ohio right now is Bob Buttigieg, who ran Trump's campaign. There was a pretty public feud between Bob Buttigieg and Matt Borges at one point, and Buttigieg wrote a letter. Buttigieg leaked a letter that said that he was severing ties with the Ohio Republican Party, something along that line, and it got very public. And then eventually it appeared that fences were mended, but maybe not. And so if Buttigieg wants Borges out, maybe that's what is going on here.
Most people in Ohio don't really care about all this political insider stuff, but what's interesting to
We have the reporters roundtable.
What's interesting to us as observers, keen observers on this, is that I think that the Republicans need to kind of get this settled before they go into the next cycle, because 2018, the governorship, the AG, the treasurer, the auditor, et cetera. So there's a lot coming up.
And all things being equal, having a party that's in such sweeping control of an entire state, cannibalizing itself isn't that unusual.
No, and frankly, it won't make any difference if the Democrats can't figure out or find some actual, like, you know, heartbeat candidates with heartbeats and ability to fund themselves, because that we have not, you know, Democrats have struggled to do that, and right now there are no obvious choices for strong challenges in a lot of these statewide races, and so until that happens, they could pretty much
doesn't really matter.
They could pick anybody at this point, and the party will roll on until the Democrats can prove otherwise.
Well, the argument could be made, and actually David Leland made it on that show that I was just talking about 2 weeks ago, that who knew in 2006 that Ted Strickland was going to be governor, that what happened in 2004, the midterm elections after George Bush's election, really shook things up in Ohio. And it created a situation where in 2006, you had Jim Petro and Ken Blackwell, who were very establishment, well-known Republicans, fighting for the Republican nomination for governor. And in the end, Blackwell got buried by Strickland. Who saw that coming? And so there's a lot of question about what might happen 2 years from now, depending on what happens in Washington here. And so, yeah, Jim's right that the Democrats do have to come forward with some candidates, but they may not be the best known people at this point. It may not matter. I mean, depending on what happens in D.C. and depending on how well the next couple of years go or how badly they go.
I would argue, though, that in 2006 that the almost sweep that the Democrats had for the statewide offices was related to the fact that there was that CoinGate scandal in the BWC, mm-hmm. and people got kind of tired of that. And so it was ripe for a big shakeup.
Well, and that's what I'm saying.
Two years is a long time.
Anything could happen. We could have all sorts politics. Of things that happen, not only in Washington, but here. So who knows?
We will be back. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Still with us, Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Let's turn to national politics for just a moment. I want to talk about this now popular refrain that voters take Donald Trump seriously, but not literally, while journalists take him literally, but not seriously. It's pithy and all that, and you know it's easy to joke about it. But I am wondering about your thoughts and how it reflects your thoughts on how to cover any politician if that's the case. I mean, I remember covering a politician back in the day and said, you just spent about $2 billion in that latest group of promises. Where's the money coming from? And they said, oh, you're just taking this all too seriously. So this isn't a new concept, making promises that you can't possibly keep.
Well, I think there are people who did take him literally who were not journalists. And you're seeing some of this on Twitter, I think, a little bit, that people are saying, wait, he's not going to do this one thing. He's not going to imprison Hillary Clinton, which we all know he couldn't do. But, you know, there I think are some people who voted for him based on certain specifics who are realizing now that those were things that were said on the campaign trail. But I think in general, there was this idea that people didn't take him literally. They looked at the overall what he hoped to do in terms of change, and they voted for that. I mean, the whole situation that came out with the tapes that Laura was referencing earlier,
grabbing women by the crotch.
There were people who tuned that out in favor of we were looking more toward what he might do for the economy. So I think that's kind of where that whole sentence of taking him literally, but not.
So can you pick and choose, though, as journalists, who you take literally versus who you don't? I mean, can you?
Well, I was speaking of voters rather than journalists.
Yes.
Of course,
but as journalists, because the point was made that journalists take them literally, voters take them, you know, but not seriously. Voters take them seriously, but not literally. How do you cover that?
I think Donald Trump is a whole new case. I mean, he's very unorthodox, unconventional, unpredictable. I mean, the fact that he's tweeting out that he would have won the popular vote if all the illegal people hadn't voted, the millions of it's completely false.
Right, but there's an example, though, of people who did take him literally. There's a video that's circulating from CNN where one of the anchors sits down with a group of Trump voters, and those claims are repeated right back to her. That 3 million people voted illegally or whatever. So there are people who are still taking him literally and
seriously.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that Donald Trump is going to continue to use Twitter either through his regular account or through the POTUS account or both to push his issues and his ideas. I mean, you know, He
was busy this weekend.
He did not like Alec Baldwin's his portrayal on Saturday Night Live of him tweeting and retweeting teenagers. And he took to Twitter to criticize Baldwin about it, which, again, it's like, isn't he supposed to be setting up an administration? Like, why is he worried about what Alec Baldwin is doing.
Well, speaking of literally, he says that it's that Saturday Night Live is unwatchable. Well, obviously he's watching, if you know.
And I don't know. I mean, as journalists, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to just ignore when he says things that are outlandish and factually incorrect? And, could you know, when he says, I'm going to deport millions of illegal immigrants, are we just supposed to ignore that and pretend, oh, well, he's not really going to do that. He's just – I mean, we don't have the book on Donald Trump's mind. We don't know what's going on inside his head. We don't when things come out of his mouth or come out on Twitter, we don't know what he's serious about and what he's just saying because he's a showman. And so, you know, I will agree that I do think that at some point the media does have to stop setting their hair on fire every time he sends out a provocative tweet, because, you know, we do need to, you know, we will need to buckle down and focus more on what is he really doing with the economy and with relations with both our enemies and our allies overseas. But I mean, I guarantee you that China is going to take him literally when he says things. And I guarantee you North Korea is going to take and Iran are going to take him literally when he makes statements. And so I think it's we're going to have to see how it all plays out, but we can't just laugh him off or just pretend like things he says don't matter. I mean, he's going to be the president now. You know, he's a pretty powerful guy. When you run the world's most powerful military, and you're the head of, you know, titular head of the largest economy in the world, you know, what you say matters. And he's going to have to learn that. But the media, too, is going to have to try to figure it all out.
Hmm. But what's unclear, though, is, I mean, it seems like when he says things like on Twitter, like burning the American flag should result in a year in jail or stripping your citizenship. That seems kind of like one of those off-the-cuff Donald Trump moments. And they actually linked it to that there was a Fox report on flag burning just moments before he issued that tweet. That seems kind of like the thing maybe we shouldn't be setting our hair on fire every time he does things like that. But I think Jim's right in terms of his messages to China, along with his taking a call from the leader of Taiwan, may indicate that there's going to be a seismic shift in how we deal with diplomatic relations with China.
Well, and it's also, I mean, some people are going to be concerned if he sees a report on TV about flag burning, and all of a sudden, as president of the United States, he puts out a tweet saying, hey, we should start putting these people in prison and kicking them out of the country. It's, you know, again, this is not playtime anymore. This is serious stuff when you start saying those kind of things and you're the leader.
And there are also people who are wondering when those kind of tweets come out, what is that a diversionary tactic? For a lot of people, I think the whole idea of flag burning, what? You know, it kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And unless you were watching this particular report on Fox. And so the question that many people might have is, well, why is he tweeting about this when there are these cabinet positions we're waiting to hear about and all these other things? Is it a diversionary tactic?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We've been talking a little bit about President-elect Donald Trump's proclivity for tweeting what's ever on his mind at any given moment. Speaking of cabinet positions, Ben Carson will be nominated to be Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. That's an interesting development.
Especially since he said a couple weeks ago he didn't want a cabinet level position.
Right. And that one that was being bandied about at that time was one that he might have some familiarity with as a physician, which was
Health and Human Services.
He had also been talked about, I think, for education,
yeah,
too. But NPR had an interview with Armstrong Williams, who was his spokesman, this morning, where he basically said that, you know, Ben Carson had kind of rethought that whole thing, and that Carson has experience in terms of growing up in public housing, and so he has many thoughts on what needs to change or what doesn't need to change or whatever. And though Armstrong Williams was very clear that he would not speculate on any possible changes that Ben Carson might make at HUD, but Ben Carson doesn't have any experience running a cabinet level agency, a government agency.
Does he have any experience running an administration at all? any executive experience?
Well, you could argue that being a doctor is making executive decisions. I
True.
Don't know. But and of course, he was a presidential candidate. But, he's not the only one, obviously, that has been appointed who has not been at the federal level
right.
heading up an agency.
He's an interesting pick because he's been very critical of federal assistance, creating too much dependency among Americans, very critical of welfare. And so now to be in housing and urban development, he may introduce some very big changes. We'll see.
Ohio House, but turning to the state house now, turning back. Ohio House Bill 476 has garnered some attention after passing the House. It would penalize people and businesses that boycott Israeli products by denying them any state contracts. And I was wondering, what about the future of that? It's just the principle of it is troubling a lot of people, not whether or not you're bashing Israeli policy and that kind of a thing, but just the idea that you would be deemed, not eligible for certain state contracts because of something else, other than whether you're qualified to provide that service or.
Yeah, there is concern, especially like the ACLU of Ohio, for one, is really talking about how concerned they are about how broad this is in terms of the way it's worded. But,
slippery slope, too.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope problem. First Amendment issues are being raised. It passed the House pretty overwhelmingly. I mean, I think there were, a dozen or so no votes. You got to wonder how, this is more about one of those bills making a statement as much mm-hmm. as anything else, but it can't, but some people definitely see it as concerning that the state would step in and say, based on your freedom, you're expressing your freedom to boycott or protest against actions or governments that you feel are doing things that are, outside of what you support, is somehow going to get you punished by the state is, some people that's troubling.
Because there's a lot of other issues out there, abortion, all kinds of stuff like that. The Ohio Senate was scheduled to vote on the confirmation of a member of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. Instead, Howard Petrikoff has resigned in advance of an expected rejection by the Senate. Petrikoff is a Democrat, but he's got a ton of experience in utilities business, and Senate Republicans are saying a lot of conflicts of interest, therefore. But he was appointed by Governor Kasich. How unusual is this, Karen Kessler?
It is kind of unusual. I think the last time a governor's appointment was rejected by the Senate was when Ted Strickland was in office. So I think this,
and back then it was controlled by the Republicans.
Right.
And so,
there was definitely some concern about Howard Petrikoff. He's a Democrat, but I think there's a rule on you can't have all Republicans on this commission.
Yeah.
But he did have some involvement in some rate cases, including the ones that First Energy and AEP had with regard to power plants and coal plants, rather. And so that was the concern that was raised. But there were some people who were wondering if this was not a little bit of a behind the scenes conflict between Keith Faber and John Kasich kind of coming out in front, that Faber wanted to block Kasich's appointment for other reasons, and we haven't heard anything about that. In fact, Faber has specifically said this was not a conflict between me and the governor, but it is an unusual circumstance when the last time this happened would have been, over 6 years ago.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, the PUCO is an incredibly powerful agency. It, the utility companies employ gobs of lobbyists to keep tabs on what's happening there. And there is a rule that you can't have – it's a five-member board and that you can't have more than three of any one party.
Yeah.
And I think that fourth member on there is deemed an independent, but it looked like actually had ties to the Republican Party. So I think the Democrats are kind of thinking that this is really an unbalanced board at this point.
Is this going to be 2 years of just – rapidly declining power by the Kasich administration? It's a lame duck period.
Well, and starting in January, the House and Senate both have one more Republican each. And so you'll have, 66 Republicans in the House and 24 Republicans in the Senate. That's a really big margin and potentially could override the governor's vetoes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a new a new place that we're at then, starting then. Because, you know, if you get to something that the governor is really concerned about, he vetoes it, it could be overridden. And that would be interesting.
They also have big enough margins in both chambers next year to attach emergency clauses to any legislation, which then make them referendum proof. It cannot be put up for referendum.
It's not, besides going into effect immediately,
right,
they would be referendum proof. Okay.
Right. So, it, you know, it'd be interesting to see if the Republican caucuses use that power on really controversial bills, like, you know, like Senate Bill 5 would have been an example of that, although that did not have – there were some Republicans that voted against it.
That would have banned
collective bargaining rights for public
employees.
And that's the classic example that most people know, is that that did pass the House and Senate by very, very slim margins. And then Democrats and union groups got a record number of signatures, put it on the ballot, and voters defeated it. But Laura's right that if you get to that point where this emergency legislation could pass, it could be that – that kind of thing could not happen.
Hmm. Yeah. And the – you know, the – I don't know that the legislature right now has the greatest of relationships with the governor, but it's not a bad relationship. But I mean, the other day, right before they were supposed to vote on the PUCO appointee Petrikov, and then they decided not to because I think they got word that he was probably going to step down. And but the governor had a meeting with Senate President Faber behind closed doors for 45 minutes. Before that occurred. And I don't know that they just talked about the PUCO appointee. My guess is they didn't. They probably talked about other things. But then the governor was brought into the chamber, and then a very impromptu, spontaneously, Faber asked him to come up and give a little speech. And it was a very unusual circumstance. I've never seen this before, where the governor is just invited into the chamber and gives a speech out of the blue. And it wasn't a speech about anything in particular. He basically got up there and reminisced and sermonized.
And then said happy holidays
and went on his way. And it was like, I talked to some senators after, and they don't know what that was about. But again, it was sort of this, it's this weird dynamic that's going on right now between President Faber and the governor. And I'm not quite sure what it's all about, but there's clearly something off there. And they need, you know, and we'll really see how it plays out next year when the governor introduces a new budget. We'll see what kind of reforms he's talking about. He's always prided himself on the big ideas, and
he's already warning though that there's not going to be that much money.
Oh yeah, and that's the other thing. There won't be a lot of money, so we'll see. You know, we'll see what they want to do with it. With what he proposes. And
you know, and at that point, Faber will no longer be the Senate president. He'll be in the House. And, you know, also it's interesting that Faber was a major supporter for Trump in Ohio. He was at a lot of the rallies, he was up on stage. So maybe maybe the rift is related to that. I'm not sure.
And he's bandied about as a potential.
He wants to run statewide in 18.
For something statewide. We want to talk about 2018. When we return, this is our weekly reporters roundtable. It's Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Just heard from Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, and also Kieran Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau Chief Kieran Kassler, and Columbus Dispatch Statehouse reporter Jim Siegel. Let's talk about 2017. Mary Taylor, there's been some announcements regarding treasurer for some fund for her campaign coming up?
Yeah, I think you mean 2018.
I'm sorry, 2018.
Yeah, so Mary Taylor has a committee called Onward Ohio, and they just hired I'm not sure how to say the last name, Uton, as the finance director. And she was a fundraiser for Betty Montgomery and for Jim Jordan. She left a job at the Ohio Chamber. So, I mean, Taylor is definitely lining up to run for governor, and there's going to be a lot of competition in that race. I think John Husted's going to run. Mike DeWine has indicated he wants to run. On the Democrat side, there's some thought that maybe Rich Cordray will come back, but it's really unclear who else the Democrats might have. Maybe I think maybe Joe Schiavone, the Senate Minority Leader, might be interested.
Yes, he said he's already reached out to all 88 county party chairs and other union leaders, other Democrats, saying he's the goal, as he put it to me, the goal is to run for governor. Mm. But, of course, the question then comes when his congressman is Tim Ryan, the Youngstown area congressman who just challenged Nancy Pelosi for minority leader and challenged unsuccessfully. He's often raised as a possible candidate for governor, and that would be interesting to have two Youngstown guys running against each other for the Democratic nomination. But I'm not sure if Tim Ryan's going to do that or not. Mm.
Right. So, I mean, I think that in the past 6 months or so, if you asked any of these folks about 2018 and running for these offices and the rest of it, they'll say, well, you know, we're really just focused on the 2016 races. And now that those are out of the way, I think you'll see some movement some lining up. You know, Josh Mandel clearly wants a rematch against Sherrod Brown for U.S. Senate in 2018. You know, we were just talking about Keith Faber. I think he wants to run for either auditor or treasurer or something like that. Dave Yost, who's the current auditor, I think he would like to run for attorney general. So, you know, there's going to be some musical chairs going on. And I think the Republicans, their problem is that if they have three strong candidates who want to run, they could end up with, you know, a very expensive, divisive primary. And the problem that the Democrats have is that they don't have any kind of strong, clear front runners that
or the money to make anybody strong.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know that Josh Mandel's going to get the opportunity to run against Sherrod Brown again. There's been a lot of talk about Congressman Pat Tiberi as the possible candidate there. But you do wonder, too, is there a possibility that somebody who wants to run for governor, would that person want to run for Senate? Though Mike DeWine actually – Sherrod Brown won his Senate seat by beating Mike DeWine in 2006. So
I think also some of it, you know, whoever gets the green light to run against Sherrod Brown, it could link back to who's running the Republican Party.
That's what I'm thinking. And obviously Josh Mandel was a supporter of Trump, right?
Right.
And Pat Tiberi is a devotee, or, you know, he took over John Kasich's congressional seat.
And before Josh Mandel was a supporter of Trump, he was a supporter of Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. So he was not a backer of John Kasich in the primary. Another name that comes out occasionally is Congressman Jim Renacci from Northeast Ohio. He's known in that area and has a lot of personal money that he could put toward running for anything here. So it wouldn't surprise me to see him try to make a bid for governor or maybe U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But nobody, I mean, actually, when you think about it, except for the statewide office holders like Dave Yost, none of them are super familiar names.
Well, Dave Yost had wanted to run for attorney general.
Right.
Six years ago. But yeah, you're right. I mean, they're familiar to us because mm-hmm. obviously we spend a lot of time with them, but I don't know how familiar they are. But that's how familiar are the names of people who run for these offices till they run for them?
Last week, Daryl Roland of the Dispatch asked whether State Treasurer Josh Mandel was trying to become the Donald Trump of Ohio by tweeting out that the attack at Ohio State was an example of radical Islamic terror. Obviously, afterward, the FBI or Homeland Security came out and said, well, there might be a link that he was influenced by that. At least he was in one of his perpetrator, you know, who was eventually shot and killed. But that in one of his Facebook rants, you know, there might have been some influence.
Although the FBI is at a press conference last week was not yet willing to make that link, and ISIS came out and claimed responsibility.
But they do that all the time.
But they do that all the time, and that was one of the points that the FBI special agent in charge, Angela Byers, what she said was that, you know, it's easy for them to come out and say, hey, we take credit for it when the perpetrator is dead.
So, you know, can anybody be a Trump besides Trump? I mean, can someone like a Josh Mandel get away with? I mean, is this going to fly? Is this the age we're going into where these offhanded remarks about any old thing, you know, flies with the politician?
Well, you do wonder how much it matters anymore. You know, after going through the election we just did, how much, you know, when you know, Donald Trump got away with saying all the things that he said about not only, you know, not only like radical Islamic terrorism, but, you know, talking, you know, making fun of the disabled reporter and the things he said about veterans and veterans' families.
And women.
And women. But I don't know that anyone can be Trump. I don't know that you you know, maybe he could pull it off. And I don't know. Maybe he wants to. Maybe he doesn't. I don't know if that's his goal. I think you put out a tweet like that to try to score some political points. But I don't know that it, you know, where it gets you in the end. I mean, you know, Donald Trump carried with him two things that people like: celebrity status and money. He's a very wealthy businessman, and those are two things that I think really helped him in the entire process. Helped him with this kind of this Teflon shield that he managed to put on and have all these things bounce off of him. But Josh Mandel does not have that, and he's also far less well known outside of Capitol Square. So. I don't know. Maybe we'll see. You know, Josh Mandel has been he has not won friends in either his party or the other party over the years for things that he's said and done. So it's not like it would be totally out of character for him to do things that are a little out of the norm.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
And also, I would argue that Donald Trump had money and celebrity, but he was also an outsider. That was part of his big appeal. I don't think that Josh Mandel is necessarily he's an outsider within his own party, but in terms of the general voters, I think they see him as a guy who was Lyndhurst city councilman and then state legislator and then treasurer. He's following a pretty typical path.
Right. And I think, you know, when we were talking about comparing possibly what happened between 2004 and 2006 and then comparing what happened in 2016 to what might happen in 2018, you know, there was a lot of talk about how 2016 was a non-establishment year. Well, Democrats could paint all of the folks who are lining up to run for governor and all these other offices as all being establishment people. These are people who are career politicians, which is, you know, a bad word, a bad phrase
Ohio,
to some
if
people.
You want change, vote Democrat.
But, you know, so
everybody's Republican. Yeah, well,
yeah,
I mean,
that's,
if that's if that's the tune they play.
Right. Well, I could see if the anti-establishment attitude still continues into 2018, yeah, that could certainly be a ploy that could be brought up. Is these are the people who've been running the state for however long you want to say they have been. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Again, 2 years is a long time.
Yes.
A lot can happen in 2 years in politics. Governor Kasich met with reporters last week. I asked you guys off air, was this his year-ender? And I'm always reminded every year, well, he doesn't really do year-enders per se. He certainly doesn't do it like former governors do, where they actually sit down one-on-one with the different news organizations. That's been over. He never has done that. He does maybe some kind of group thing at the end, but even to meet with reporters on any level is unusual for John Kasich at this point.
Yeah, this was at the press conference for the self-driving semi that was announced in that smart corridor on Route 33 between Dublin and East Liberty. But after that, he talked to some reporters, did a quick gaggle, and was asked a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's rare that we get those anymore because he hasn't done a whole lot of events. And sometimes when he does events, he doesn't speak to reporters mm-hmm. afterward. So it's always interesting when we get a chance to ask the governor some questions that go beyond the event that we're right mm-hmm. there standing and hearing about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's talk about a couple issues in the waning minutes here. This is the last week of the lame duck session for the Ohio General Assembly. They start back at square one when the new session, two-year session, starts up in January. I want to talk about the bill that would override local ordinances when it comes to where pet stores can buy their dogs. That's still in the works, but now perhaps will be paired with another tangentially related measure. Jim Siegel, what's the deal?
Well, there's a law in Grove City and also one in Toledo dealing with where pet stores are allowed to purchase puppies. And there's a number of animal welfare groups that want them to be banned from purchasing from these large scale breeding operations, some of which have been heavily criticized for the way they treat the dogs that normally the ones that, you know, the ones giving birth.
Mm-hmm.
And so these ordinances, local ordinances have been passed to basically limit them to, getting their dogs from, you know, animal shelters and other smaller operations. Well, this would override that, and it's controversial. There's some protections in there, but the animal welfare folks say it's not very good, and so they So it's already passed the Senate. It's being debated in the House. And one of the things in politics that folks like to do sometimes is they take a bill you don't like, you know, that people don't like, and attach a bill to it they do like. So what they're talking about doing is taking the Petland bill and amending into it a bill that would ban or make illegal bestiality, which, you know, having sex with animals. This is not specifically illegal in Ohio. We're one of 11 states where it's not yet illegal, and some folks think that's it'd be a good idea if we did make it illegal. So animal welfare folks are very supportive of that bill. So what, you know, so they'll attach that bill to the Petland bill and make it harder to oppose the whole package and make it frankly harder for the members to vote no, which is ultimately what they want to do.
Hmm. Yeah, imagine that in a campaign ad. This guy voted against the bestiality bill.
That's a bill that when that came up, it was kind of like there's so little time in lame duck. And that came up. And I even asked a lobbyist that I saw, why is this happening now? And he told me, well, there's all this stuff on the internet and chat rooms and whatever. Okay. So, I mean, it's kind of one of those laws that you didn't know that there wasn't a law, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, all I can say is yuck.
I know, right?
Lawmakers are still at work on a measure that would cut unemployment benefits in Ohio. The measure would also raise employer taxes, unemployment taxes, during the same period between 2017, 2030, but by a much smaller rate than it would cut benefits.
Right. I mean, even the fiscal notes about this that were prepared by the LSC, the office in the General Assembly, have said that it's not a balance, that this is not a balanced cut in benefits to a balance of how much
increase
employer mm-hmm. taxes. So that's been a bill that's been controversial since the very beginning. And the question is, how quickly can they get this done? Because they want to get this done now before there's any sort of economic problems.
Right. I mean, this is the right time to do it when they don't need it.
Right. When there's no recession going on. You don't want to try to be figuring out how you're going to shore up the unemployment compensation fund when you're getting ready to pay out benefits to many, many jobless workers. So there's a little bit of pressure, I think, to get that one done. I think there's a hearing on that this afternoon.
Hmm. Yeah, and this has been an issue for, you know, more than a decade, the insolvency of the unemployment compensation fund. And there's, I think last year, almost 200,000 Ohioans received jobless checks.
Yeah. And under this, you know, this obviously the goal is to save money so that the fund is solvent. 83% of the savings under this bill come from jobless workers. 17% come from business.
Who get less in benefits.
Who get less in benefits. Their benefits get frozen. They get fewer weeks generally. And only 17% would come from businesses through raising the taxable wage base, and that is drawing fire. And frankly, I understand that this is not going to be easy to get this done by end of the week. This is a priority bill, but there is a lot of clashing going on right now. Labor unions are very unhappy with that. This is just a really they continue to say this is a very unbalanced bill. The House Senate, despite being very Republican, is generally more pro-labor than the House. And so we'll see how this all works out. There's definitely some members in there that are, you know, Senator Patton, Senator Hughes, and some others who are more pro-labor and are not going to, you know, maybe have a much harder time swallowing this bill than the House will.
Two other quick ones. The concealed carry bill that would put some restrictions on college campuses and then also the bill that would allow for lawmakers to decide if certain agencies can disappear after two years. And that's a priority because, as we mentioned, Senate President Keith Faber is leaving the Senate, going over to the House.
I'd be surprised if the governor signed that bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I interrupted you, Laura.
Oh, I was going to say the unemployment compensation bill, although labor is really fighting on this, it does affect all workers.
Not just organized labor.
Correct.
It's just that organized labor is fighting on behalf of all workers.
Right. And businesses will say that they've been paying higher taxes for a long time and that they want to break.
They have been because this fund wasn't adequately funded in the beginning, and so they had to borrow the money from the federal government and they had to pay interest on
that.
Yeah,
they've kicked this can down the road for two decades.
Right. Well, Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, thanks so much for joining us.
No problem.
Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, thanks to you as well.
Always a fun time.
And Karen Kassler, bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks as always.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Cool.